You could stop now! You've killed the riders! You could stop!
Neither Julian nor Emma seemed to hear. With a graceful hand, Emma lifted a cohort member from the screaming throng and tossed him aside. He shrieked as he sailed through the air, his howls cut off suddenly when he hit the ground with a crushing thud. Mark had stopped worrying about whether Emma and Julian would survive this. He had begun to worry whether any of them would. Drew stood just inside the gates and gazed out onto the imperishable fields. She'd never seen a battle like this before. She'd been in the Accords Hall during the Dark War and seen death and blood, but the scale of this fight, the chaos that was hard to follow, the blinding speed of the fighting, was almost impossible to look at. It didn't help that she was too far away to make out details. She saw the bronze riders come and felt terror. She saw them tumble into the fighting crowd, but not what had happened to them afterward. Occasionally, she would see the blurry figure of a man or woman fall on the field and wonder, was that Mark? Was it Emma? A sickness of fear had taken up residence in her stomach and wouldn't budge. For the past hour, the wounded had been coming through the gates, sometimes walking, sometimes carried. Silent Brothers moved forward in swirls of bone-colored robes to carry cohort members and ordinary shadow hunters alike to the Basilius for healing. At one point, Jem Carstairs had come in through the gates carrying Kit's unconscious body. She had started to run to them and paused when she saw Tessa Gray racing through the crowd of Silent Brothers, Katarina Loss with her. Both already had blood on their clothes and had clearly been treating the wounded. She wanted to go to Kit. He was her friend and he mattered so much to Ty. But she hung back, afraid that adults like Jem and Tessa would want her to go back to Amatis's house, and she would be taken away from the gates, her only window to her family. She hung back in the shadows as Tessa helped Katarina load Kit onto a stretcher. Jem and Katarina took hold of the ends of the stretcher. Before they began to move up the hill toward the Basilius, Tessa bent and kissed Kit gently on the forehead. It eased the knot of tightness in Drew's chest. Though Kit had been hurt, at least he'd be taken care of by those who cared about him. More wounded came in then, the injuries worsening as the battle raged on. Beatriz Mendoza was carried through the gates, sobbing brokenly. She wasn't visibly injured, but Drew knew that her parabatai, Julie, had been the first shadow hunter slain in the battle. Drew wanted to turn Tabby's face away from all of it. It wasn't the shadow hunter way to shield children from the results of battle, but she couldn't help thinking of his nightmares, the years of listening to him scream in the darkness. Tavs, she said finally, don't look. He took her hand, but he didn't turn his face away. He was staring at the battlefield, his expression intent but not fearful. He was the one who saw the giants first and pointed. Drew's first instinct was to wonder if this was a plan of Julian's. She saw a white fire blaze up, and then great, shining figures striding across the field. They filled her with a feeling of amazement, a shock at their beauty, the way she'd felt when she was small, looking up at illustrations of Rossio. She scanned the field anxiously. The white light of the fire was piercing the sky. The clouds were breaking up and shattering. She could hear cries, and the dark figures of vampires began to flee across the field toward Broslin's shadows. Most of them made it, but as the clouds rolled back and the gray sunlight pierced down like a knife, Drew saw one vampire, slower than the rest, just at the border of the woods, stumble into a patch of sunlight. There was a cry and a conflagration. She pulled her gaze away from the flames. This can't be Julian's plan. Tabby tugged on her hand.
We have to go, he said. We have to go to Emma and Jules.
She gripped him tightly.
It's a battle. We can't go out there.
We have to.
There was urgency in his tone.
It's Jules and Emma. They need us.
Drew!
A cry made her look up. Two people were coming through the gates. One was Jaime. The sight of him made her heart leap. He was still alive.
dusty and scratched, his gear filthy, but alive and bright-eyed and flushed with effort. He was half-carrying Cameron Ashdown, who had his arm slung over his shoulder. Cameron appeared to be bleeding from a wound in his side.
"Cameron," Drew hurried toward him, pulling Tavi with her. "Are you okay?"
Cameron gave Drew a half-wave.
"Vanessa stabbed me. Some kind of demon stuff on the blade."
He winced.
"Your cousin stabbed you?"
Drew said. She'd known the Ashdowns were split politically, but family was family in her view.
"Holiday dinners will be very awkward from now on," said Jaime. He gave the other boy a pat on the back as a Silent Brother swooped down on Cameron and bore him away to the Basilius. Jaime wiped a dirty hand across his forehead.
"You two should get further away from the battle," he said. "Has no one told you not to stand in the gates?"
"If we don't stand in the gates, we can't see anything," Drew pointed out. "Is that on the field? Is that really Jules and Emma?"
Jaime nodded. Drew's heart sank. Some part of her had hoped it was a terrible illusion.
"I don't understand what's happening," her voice rose. "Is this a plan of Julian's? Do you know about it?"
"I do not think it's a plan," Jaime said. "They seem entirely out of control."
"Can they be stopped?"
Jaime spoke reluctantly.
"They killed the riders of Manon. Now soldiers are trying to form a wall of bodies to protect the city from them. All the children are here."
He indicated Alicante. Drew thought of Max and Rafe with Maris. Her heart skipped a beat.
"I don't know what will happen."
Jaime looked from her to Tavi.
"Come with me," he said abruptly. "I can get you into the woods."
Drew hesitated.
"We can't go away from them. We have to go to Jules and Emma," Tavi said firmly.
"It's dangerous," Jaime began.
"Tavi's right. We have to go."
Drew looked down at the incomplete rune that sprawled across her forearm. She remembered Julian putting it there yesterday. It felt forever ago.
"You don't have to help."
Jaime sighed and drew his crossbow from the holder on his back.
"I'll cover you."
Drew was about to follow Jaime out of the gates when Tavi poked her in the side. She turned to see he was holding out her steely.
"Don't forget," he said.
She exhaled. She nearly had forgotten. Drew put the tip of the steely to her arm and began to complete the Familius rune. Kieran was surrounded by the Unseelie army, 30 fairies deep. This was bad enough, because he could see neither Mark nor Christina over the churning mass of his people, but he could barely control Windspear, who was rearing and whinnying beneath him. Windspear liked neither crowds nor giants, and at the moment both were far too close. Winter was at Kieran's side. He had stuck to him like glue through the battle, which Kieran found both admirable and startling. He was not used to such loyalty.
"The people have come to you, liege lord," said Winter. "What are your orders for them?"
"Orders for them?" Kieran thought frantically. He had no idea what they should do. This is why he had wanted Adayan to be king. But Adayan was a prisoner in the Seelie court. What would Adayan say about an army of fairies trapped on a field with rampaging part-angel giants?
"Why aren't they all running for the forest?"
Kieran demanded.
The forest was a place fair folk felt at home, full of natural things, water and trees. There had long been fairies in Brosland Forest.
"Sadly, the woods are full of vampires," said Winter glumly.
"Vampires are our allies,"
shouted Kieran, grasping Windspear's mane as the horse reared.
"No one really believes that," said Winter. "By all the gods of dark and light."
Kieran wanted to yell and break something. Windspear reared again, and this time Kieran caught sight of a familiar figure. Mark. You would know him anywhere, and Christina beside him. He said a silent thanks. What would they tell me to do? He thought of Mark's generosity, Christina's kindness. They would think of the Unseelie soldiers first.
"We need to get our people off this field," said Kieran. "They cannot battle angels. No one can. How did you all arrive here?"
"Obon made a door," said Winter. "You can do the same, liege. Open a door to Ferry. As king, you can do it. Reach out to your land, and it will reach back to you."
If bloody drunk Obon did it, I can do it, Kieran thought. But that wasn't all that helpful. He had to reach out to his land, a place he had long cursed, and hope it would reach back to him. He slid from Windspear's back as the horse stilled beneath him. He remembered Mark saying, I will not forget the beauty of Faerie, and neither will you, but it will not come to that. And he thought of what he himself had said, had remembered when he had thought Faerie was threatened. The way the water tumbles blew his ice over Bronwyn's falls, a taste of music in the sound of wine, the honey hair of mermaids in the streams, the glittering of will-o'-the-wisps in the shadows of the deep forests. Kieran took a deep breath. Let me through, he thought. Let me through, my land, for I belong to you. I will give unto you as the kings of Faerie long have, and you will flourish when I flourish. I will bring no blight to your shores, nor blood to wither your flowers in the fields, but only peace, and a kind road that rises to green hills. My liege, said Winter. Kieran opened his eyes and saw that the low hillock before him had begun to split apart. Through the gap he could see the great tower of Unseelie rising in the distance, and the peaceful fields before it. Several of the closer fey sent up a cheer. They began to run through the gap even as it widened. Kieran could see them emerging on the other side, some even falling on their knees with gratitude and relief. Winter, he said in an unsteady voice. Winter, get everyone through the door. Get them to safety. All the fey, said Winter. Everyone, said Kieran, looking at his first in command sternly. Shadowhunters, warlocks, everyone who seeks sanctuary. And you, my liege, said Winter. I must go to Mark and Christina. For the first time, Winter looked mutinous. You must leave your mortal friends, lord. Winter was a redcap, sworn in blood to protect the king and the royal line. Kieran could not be angry with him, and yet he must make him understand. He searched for the right words. You are my loyal guard, Winter, but as you guard me, so you must guard what I love best. And Mark Blackthorn and Christina Rosales are what I love best in this world, and all others. But your life, said Winter. Winter, Kieran said flatly. I know they cannot be my consorts, but I die without them. More and more fairies were flooding through the door to the Undying Lands. There were others with them now, a few warlocks, even a band of lycanthropes. Winter set his jaw. Then I will guard your back. Helen felt as if she were caught in the middle of a river going two ways at once. Fairies were running in one direction, toward a hilly rise at the eastern end of the field. Shadow hunters were racing in the other toward the city of Alicante, presumably to hide behind its walls. Aline had darted off to investigate, promising to be back momentarily. Some still milled around the center of the field. The cohort seemed to be shrieking and running in circles, willing to join neither the exodus of fairies nor fellow shadow hunters. Helen had stayed near to where the others she knew had gathered. Kadir and Gia were helping the wounded from the field. Simon and Isabel were in conference with Hypatia Vex and Quasi Bediako, and Jason Clary had gone with a group of others, including Rayon and Divya, to put themselves between Emma and Julian and the cohort prisoners. Helen? Aline was jogging toward her across the grass. They're not running away. What do you mean? Helen said. The shadow hunters. They're going to protect the city in case the giants, in case Emma and Julian make a move toward it. It's full of kids and old people, and besides, she added, shadow hunters protect Alicante. It's what we do. Spoken like the daughter of the consul. But Emma and Julian would never... They wouldn't... Helen protested. We don't know what they do, Aline said gently, just as Hypatia Vex and Quasi Bediako rushed past them. They raced toward the grass where Emma and Julian stood, and Quasi flung out his hands as Hypatia placed her palms on his shoulders. A shimmering golden net burst into the air, over Emma and Jules. It settled on them like a fine spider web, but Helen sensed it was made of something much stronger. Emma put up a great, shining hand to push against the net. It held fast. Kwasi was breathing fast, but Hypatia steadied him. A cry broke from Martin Gladstone.
"Do it now! Round up the Blackthorns! Show those monsters what'll happen to their families if they don't stop!"
The cohort sent up a cheer. Helen could hear Zara screaming that they should do it, that they had the right to protect themselves. Aline stepped in front of Helen.
"That bastard," she glowered.
Julian hooked his fingers into the material of the shining net and tore it apart. It fell away, and Julian reached down to seize Gladstone. With a flick of his fingers, he snapped Gladstone's neck. Julian and Emma moved toward the other cohort members, who began to scatter. Emma reached for Zara, and Jace slid between them, between Emma's shimmering hand and Zara's fleeing figure. The mortal sword was sheathed on his back. He was weaponless. He tossed back his golden head and called out,
"Stop! Emma and Julian? The battle is over! Stop!"
Expressionless as a statue of an avenging angel, Emma reached down and swept Jace out of the way. He was thrown several yards and hit the ground with an ugly thud. Clary screamed and went flying across the grass, racing towards Jace, with her red hair trailing behind her like fire.
"Get up. Get up," Helen thought. "Get up, Jace." But he didn't.
Drew had never used a Familius rune before, and the experience was a strange one. She felt herself tugged toward her siblings in a way she couldn't define. It felt like something was tied around the inside of her spine, which was gross but interesting, and was pulling her toward a destination. She'd heard the way tracking runes felt described to her, and she suspected this wasn't dissimilar. She let the tugging pull her, running along after it with her hand clasped firmly around Tavi's wrist. They kept to the edges of the battlefield, Jaime beside them with his crossbow trained on anyone who might approach. They left the shelter of the city walls and struck out for the edge of the forest, still following the pull of the rune. She tried not to look over at the field, at Emma and Julian. It was like looking at pillars of fire one moment and terrible monsters the next. There was a rustling overhead, and Ty dropped down out of an oak tree. Drew gave a little gasp of surprise, and then another one as Ty walked straight toward her and hugged her tightly. He let her go and frowned.
"Why are you on the field? You should be in the city. Tavi, too." He turned to Jaime. "It's dangerous."
"Yes," said Jaime, "I am aware of that."
"You're out here," Drew pointed out.
"I was up a tree," Ty said, as if that made it better somehow.
Before Drew could get into a really enjoyable sibling argument about it, Helen came rushing up, her pale blonde curls fluttering. Aline was just on her heels.
"Drew! Tavi!"
Helen darted tearfully toward the two of them, reaching to pick Tavi up. Drew noticed that he held his arms out to her automatically, something he only really had ever done for Julian before. Helen lifted him up and squeezed him hard.
"What are you two doing here? Drew, did you use the Familius rune on purpose?"
"Of course I did," Drew said.
"We have to get out there on the field. We have to stop Emma and Jules. We have to get them back to themselves."
"We've been trying," Helen said as she set Tavi down. "Don't you think we've been trying?"
Drew wanted to grind her teeth together. Why didn't Helen listen? She thought things were better, but she needed her sister to hear her so badly she could feel it like a lump in her throat. She knew what they had to do. It seemed so clear. How could she make the rest of them see it? She felt a twinge in her arm, where the rune was, and then Mark was there, racing up with Christina at his side.
"Drew, you called us."
He saw Ty and smiled delightedly.
"I was watching you with your slingshot," he said. "Your aim is true, little brother."
"Don't encourage him, Mark," said Helen. "He was supposed to stay back at camp."
"Look," Drew said. "I don't know if it makes much sense, but if we all go up to Emma and Jules together, if we go right up to them and talk to them, we can get through. We have to try.
If we can't do it, no one can. And then everyone is in danger. Helen shook her head. But why is this happening?
Christina and Mark exchanged a glance that Drew couldn't decipher.
I think it is because of the Parabatai bond, Christina said.
Because Emma almost died? Aline said, bewildered.
I do not know, Christina said. I can only guess. But there is heavenly fire burning inside them, and no mortal being can survive that for very long.
It's too dangerous for us to approach them, Mark said. We have to trust Emma and Julian. Trust that they can end this on their own.
There was a long pause. Jaime watched impassively as the Blackthorns and their extended family stood in the stillness of an intense silence.
No,
Helen said finally, and Drew's heart sank. Helen raised her eyes, blazing Blackthorn blue in her grime-streaked face.
Drew is right. We have to go.
She looked at Drew.
You're right, my love.
I will walk with you to the field,
Jaime said to Drew. She was glad for his company as they all set out, Blackthorns together. But it wasn't Jaime she was thinking about as they turned to walk toward the heart of the battle. It was her sister.
Helen believed me. Helen understood.
In the midst of the darkness of battle, her heart felt a tiny bit lighter. Jaime suddenly jerked upright.
Diego,
he said, and then a torrent of Spanish. Drew and Helen whipped around, and Drew sucked in her breath. Not far away, a redcap was dragging Diego's limp body across the field. At least Drew guessed it was Diego. His clothes were familiar, and his mop of dark hair, but his face was obscured entirely by blood. Helen touched Jaime's shoulder.
Go to your brother, she said. Quickly. We'll be fine.
Jaime took off running. Jace was awake. He had been blinking and starting to sit up when Clary reached him, and she'd been torn between throwing herself into his arms and smacking him for terrifying her. She was drawing an Arazi on his arm. It seemed to be doing its work. The long, bloody scratch along the side of his face had already healed. He was half sitting up, leaning against her to catch his breath, when Alec came running up and knelt down beside him.
Are you all right, Parabatai?
Alec said, looking anxiously into Jace's face.
Please promise me you'll never do that again, Clary said.
I promise that I will never stand between Zara Dearborn and a marauding giant again, said Jace. Alec, what's happening?
You've been out on the field. Julian and Emma just tossed Vanessa Ash down about 20 feet, said Alec.
I think they're angry that she stabbed Cameron, though why, I couldn't tell you.
Clary looked over at Emma and Julian. They stood very still, looking down at the cohort, as if choosing what to do with them. Every once in a while, a cohort member would break free and run, and Emma or Julian would move to pen them back in again. It was almost like a game, but angels did not play. Clary couldn't help but remember the sight of Raziel rising from Lake Lynn. Not many people had looked at an angel. Not many people had stared into the cold eyes of heaven, with its indifference to petty mortal concerns. Did Emma and Julian feel a fraction of that indifference? That unconcern that was not cruelty, but something stranger and altogether bigger. Something not human at all. Emma suddenly lurched and went down on one knee. Clary stared in shock as the cohort howled and fled, but Emma made no movement toward them. Julian beside her reached down a shining hand to lift her back up.
They're dying, Jace said quietly.
Alec looked puzzled.
What?
They are Nephilim.
True Nephilim, said Jace. The monsters of old who once strode the earth. They have heavenly fire inside them, powering everything they do. But it's too much. Their mortal bodies will burn away. They're probably in agony.
He got to his feet. We have to stop them. If they get too maddened with pain, who knows what they'll do? Emma began to move toward the city. Clary could see Isabel and Simon running toward the blockade of shadow hunters standing between Emma and Julian and the city of Alicante.
"Stop them how?" Alex said.
Grimly, Jace unsheathed the mortal sword. Before he could move, Clary put a hand on his shoulder.
"Wait," she said. "Look."
Not far away, a small group was walking steadily toward the shining, monstrous figures of Emma and Julian. Helen Blackthorne, with all her siblings beside her. Mark and Tiberius, Drusilla and Octavian. They moved together in a strong and steady line.
"What are they doing?" Alec asked.
"The only thing they can do," said Clary. Slowly, Jace lowered the mortal sword.
"By the angel," he said, drawing in his breath. "Those kids."
"Diego, wake up, my brother. Please, wake up."
There had been only darkness, interspersed with bright sparks of pain. Now there was Jaime's voice. Diego wanted to stay in the darkness and the quiet, to rest where the pain was held at arm's length, here in the silent world. But his brother's voice was insistent, and from childhood Diego had been trained to respond to it, to rise from bed when his brother cried, to run to help him when he fell down. He peeled his eyes open. They felt sticky. His face burned. Above him was roiling dark sky and Jaime, his expression starkly distraught. He was on his knees, his bow at his side. A distance away, a redcap lay dead with an arrow protruding from its chest. Jaime was clutching a steely in his hand. He reached out and pushed back Diego's hair, and when he drew his hand back, it was red with blood.
"Stay still," he said. "I have given you several irazis."
"I must get up," Diego whispered. "I must fight."
Jaime's dark eyes flashed.
"Your face is sliced open, Diego. You have lost blood. You cannot get up. I will not allow it."
"Jaime."
"In the past, you have always healed me," said Jaime. "Let me be the one who heals you."
Diego coughed, his mouth and throat were thick with blood.
"How bad? How bad would the scars be?"
Jaime took his hand, and that was when Diego knew it was bad indeed. He begged Jaime silently not to lie to him or to pity him. Jaime's smile was slow and crooked.
"I think I will be the pretty one in the family now," he said. "But at least you're still very muscular."
Diego choked on a laugh, on the taste of blood, on the strangeness of it all. He wound his fingers into his brother's and held on tight. The walk across the field was surreal. As the siblings came closer to Emma and Julian, other shadow hunters drew nearer to the Blackthorns, sometimes looking puzzled, sometimes looking ashamed. Drew knew they felt that the group was walking toward certain death. Some called out that they should leave Tavi behind, but he only pressed closer to his brothers and sisters, shaking his head. Emma and Julian were clearly making their way toward the city. They moved like shining shadows, closing the distance between themselves and the barricade of shadow hunters who stood between them and Alicante.
"We need to get to them," she muttered, but the crowd in front of them was forming another sort of barricade. She saw shadow hunters she recognized among them. Anoush and Divya Joshi, Luana Carvalho, Kadir Safar, and even some downworlders. Bat Velasquez and Quasi Beriaco among them, who were calling out to them not to approach Julian and Emma, that it wasn't safe. She glanced at the others in panic.
"What do we do?"
"I cannot shoot them with elf bolts," Mark said. "They mean well."
"Of course not,"
Helen looked horrified.
"Please," she called out, "let us pass."
But her voice was lost in the roar of the crowd, which was jostling them back, away from the city, away from Emma and Jules. Drew had begun to panic when they heard the thunder of hooves. Shadow hunters moved reluctantly back as Windspear, Kieran on his back, parted the crowd. His flanks were lathered with sweat. He had clearly raced across the field. Kieran's panicked eyes flew across the group until he found Mark and then Christina.
The three of them exchanged a swift and speaking look. Mark flung his hand up as if he were reaching out to the new Unseelie King.
"Kieran," he shouted, "help us. We need to get to Emma and Julian."
Drew waited for Kieran to say that it was dangerous, impossible. Instead, he bent low over Winspear's neck. He seemed to be whispering to the horse. A moment later, the sky darkened with flying shapes. The Wild Hunt had come. Shadow hunters and downworlders alike scattered as the hunt swooped low. Suddenly the Blackthorns could move forward again, and they did, moving as fast as they could toward Emma and Julian, who had nearly closed the gap between themselves and the line of shadow hunters guarding the city. As they passed, Drew reached up to wave at Diana and Gwyn, who had detached themselves from the Wild Hunt and were preparing to land alongside the Blackthorns. Diana smiled at her and pressed her hand over her heart. Drew fixed her eyes on the goal ahead. They were nearly there. Kieran had joined them. The crown of Unseelie gleamed on his brow, but his attention was fixed on protecting the Blackthorns. With Windspear rearing, he was keeping the crowd at bay on one side while Gwyn and Diana did the same on the other. The field leveled out. They were close now, close enough that Emma and Julian were shining blurs. It was like looking at trees in the forest whose tops you couldn't see. Drew took a deep breath.
"Okay," she said. "Just us now. Just Blackthorns."
Everyone went still. Mark pressed his forehead to Christina's, his eyes shut, before helping her up onto Windspear beside Kieran. Kieran squeezed Mark's hand tightly and wrapped his arms around Christina as if to say to Mark that he would keep her safe. Aline kissed Helen softly and went to stand by her mother among the crowd. They watched, a small and worried group, as the Blackthorns set off to close the distance between themselves and Emma and Jules. They stopped a few feet from the giant figures of Julian and Emma. For a moment, the certainty that had carried Drew this far faltered. She had thought only of getting here, not of what she would do or say when they arrived. It was Tavi who stepped forward first.
"Jules!" he shouted. "Emma! We're here!"
And at last Emma and Julian reacted. They turned away from the city and looked down at the Blackthorns. Drew craned her head back. She could see their expressions. They were completely blank. No recognition lived in their glowing eyes. "We can't just tell them to stop," said Mark. "Everyone's already tried that." Tavi moved a little bit further forward. The eyes of the giants followed him like massive lamps, glowing and inhuman. Drew wanted to reach out and snatch him back.
"Jules," he said,
and his voice was small and low and stabbed into Drusilla's heart. She took a deep breath. If Tavi could approach them, so could she. She moved to stand behind her younger brother and tilted her shoulders back until she was looking directly up at Emma and Julian. It was like gazing into the sun. Her eyes prickled, but she held them open.
"Emma," she called. "Julian, it's Drew. Drusilla, look, everyone is telling you to stop because the battle is won, but I'm not here to say that. I'm here to tell you to stop. Because we love you. We need you. Come back to us."
Neither Emma nor Julian moved or changed expression. Drew plowed on, her cheeks burning.
"Don't leave us," she said. "Who will watch bad horror movies with me, Julian, if you're gone? Who will train with me, Emma, and show me everything I'm doing wrong, and how to be better?"
Something shifted behind Drew. Helen had come to stand beside her. She reached her hands out as if she could touch the shining figures before her.
"Julian," she said, "you raised our brothers and sisters when I could not. You sacrificed your childhood to keep our family together. And Emma, you guarded this family when I could not. If you both leave me now, how will I ever get a chance to make it up to you?"
Julian and Emma were still expressionless. But Emma tilted her head slightly, almost as if she was listening. Mark came forward, laying his slim hand on Drew's shoulder. He craned his head back.
Julian, he called. You showed me how to be part of a family again. Emma, you showed me how to be a friend when I had forgotten friendship. You gave me hope when I was lost.
He stood straight as an elf bolt, gazing into the sky.
Come back to us.
Julian shifted. It was a minute movement, but Drew felt her heart leap. Maybe. Maybe. Ty stepped forward, his gear dusty and ripped where bark had torn it. His black hair fell in dark strands across his face. He pushed it away and said,
We lost Livy. We lost her.
Tears stung the back of Drew's eyes. There was something about the tone of Ty's voice that made it sound as if this were the first time he had realized the finality and irrevocability of Livy's death. Ty's eyelashes shimmered with tears as he raised his gaze.
We can't lose you too. We will wind up broken. Julian, you taught me what every word I didn't understand meant. And Emma, you chased off anybody who was ever mean to me, who will teach me and protect me if you don't go back to being yourselves.
There was a great, thundering crash. Julian had fallen to his knees. Drew covered a gasp. He seemed smaller than he had, though still enormous. She could see the black fissures in his glowing skin where red sparks of fire leaked out like blood. There is a heavenly fire burning inside them, and no mortal being can survive that for very long. Emma, Drew whispered. Julian. They weren't expressionless anymore. Drew had seen statues of mourning angels, of angels thrust through with fiery swords, weeping tears of agony. It was not easy to wield a sword for God. She could see those statues again in the looks on their faces.
Emma!
A cry burst from Christina, who had broken away from the others and came rushing toward the Blackthorns.
Emma! Who will be my best friend if you're not my best friend, Emma?
She was crying, tears mixing with the blood and dirt on her face.
Who will take care of my best friend when I cannot, Julian, if you are not there?
Emma fell to her knees beside Julian. They were both weeping. Tears of fire, red and gold. Drew hoped desperately that it meant that they felt something, and not that they were dying, coming apart in twin blazes of fire.
Who will drive me crazy with questions in the classroom if not you?
Called Diana. She was coming toward them as well, and so were Kieran and Aline, leaving Gwyn holding Windspear's bridle, his face reflecting awe and wonder. Aline cleared her throat.
Emma and Julian, she said. I don't know you that well. And this giant thing is admittedly a huge surprise. That wasn't a pun, I was being literal.
She glanced sideways at Helen.
But being around you makes my wife really happy. And that's because she loves you both.
She paused.
I also like you, and we're going to be a family, damn it, so come down here and be with this family.
Helen patted Aline's shoulder.
That was good, honey.
Julian,
Kieran said.
I could speak of the way Mark loves you, and Emma. I could speak of the friendship Christina bears you, but the truth is that I have to be king of the Unseelie court. And without your brilliance, Julian, and your bravery, Emma, I fear my reign will be brief.
In the distance, Drew could see Isabel and Simon approaching. Alec was with them, his arm around Magnus, and Clary and Jace walked beside them, hand in hand. Tavi reached up his arms.
Jules,
he said, his small voice clear and ringing.
Carry me. I'm tired. I want to go home.
Slowly as the passing of eons, Julian reached out with his bright hands, fissured with darkness from which heavenly fire poured like blood. He reached out toward Tavi.
There was a burst of light that seared Drew's eyes. When she had blinked it away, she saw that Julian and Emma were no longer there. No, they had slumped to the ground. They were dark figures within an aura of light, growing ever smaller, surrounded by a pool of illumination, the color of bloody gold. For a terrified moment, Drew was sure they were dying. As the awful light faded, she saw Emma and Julian, human size again, crumpled together on the ground. They lay with their hands clasped together, their eyes closed, like angels who had fallen from heaven, and now slept peacefully upon the earth again.
Chapter 33, Reverence.
Wake up, Emma. It's time to wake up.
There was a gentle hand on her forehead, a gentle voice calling her out of the long dark. For some time, there had been only shadows. Shadows and cold after a long period of burning. The world had tilted at a distance. She had seen a place too bright to remember, and figures that shone like blades in the sun. She had heard voices calling her name. Emma. Emma.
Emma means universe, Julian had said. But she had not woken up. She had heard Julian's voice again, this time mixed with Jem's.
It was a clever touch, Jem said, having not one meeting but two. You knew any of the shadow hunters might be loyal to the cohort, so you had them attend only the first meeting. That way, when they reported to Horus what your plans were, he was prepared only for you to interrupt the parley, not for the downworlder attack.
Jason Clary agreed to be the bait, Julian said. He sounded tired, even in her dream. We knew Horus would do anything to get his hands on them. That way, we could march them out in front of everyone and prove that Horus wasn't just wrong that they were dead. He was trying to kill them. There was a long pause. Emma floated in more darkness, though she could see shapes in it now, shapes and shadows.
I knew there would be spies at the meeting, Julian said. I admit they surprised me by sending a demon. I didn't even figure it out until I saw the Eidolon on the battlefield. How do you think it got into the sanctuary? Just posing as Oscar Lindquist shouldn't have protected it.
Demons have been known to use Shadow Hunter blood to enter institutes. Oscar Lindquist was found dead yesterday. It is possible his blood was used.
But would that grant the demon the power to be invulnerable to Seraph blades? Julian said. There was a long pause.
I know of no magic strong enough for that. Jem sounded troubled. The Silent Brothers will want to know.
Emma dragged her eyes open reluctantly, not wanting to leave the softness of the dark.
Jem?
She whispered. Her throat and mouth were incredibly dry.
Emma.
She was pulled into a hug. Jem's arms were strong. She pressed her head into his shoulder. It was like being hugged by her father. A memory she kept always in the back of her mind, precious and unforgotten. She swallowed past the dryness in her throat.
Julian?
She whispered. Jem drew back. She was able to see where she was. In a small room with two white beds, a window in the wall letting in sunshine. Julian sat on the bed opposite hers, wearing a clean t-shirt and loose pants like training garments. Someone had put her into the same clothes. Her hair was tangled, and her whole body ached like a giant bruise. Julian looked unharmed. Their eyes met, and his expression softened. His back was straight and tense, his shoulders a hard line.
She wanted to go and hug him,
at least to hold his hand. She forced herself not to move. She felt fragile inside, her heart thundering with love and fear. She didn't trust herself to control her emotions.
You're in the Basileus, said Jem. I woke you, Emma, after Julian had woken. I thought you would want to see each other.
Emma looked around. Through a window in the wall, she could see a bigger room of white-sheeted cots, about half of which were taken up with patients. Silent Brothers moved along the rows, and the air smelled of healing,
herbs and flowers, the medicines of the silent city. Their room had a low-arched ceiling, painted with healing runes in gold and red and black. More windows faced out onto the buildings of Alicante, the red-roofed houses, the slim needles of the demon towers.
The children. Are they all right?
Emma said. Helen?
I already asked,
Julian said. It was hard for Emma to look away from him, and also painful to look at him. He seemed different somehow, changed. She tore her gaze free and stared at Jem, who had risen to stand by the window.
Everyone's all right, Emma.
Even Kit? He saved my life.
He was quite drained and ill, said Jem. But he has recovered well. He is in the Silent City. We lost good warriors on the battlefield, but your friends are safe. You have been unconscious for 3 days, so you missed the funerals. But then, you've attended too many funerals lately as it is. Emma frowned.
But why is Kit in the Silent City? The Basilius?
Emma, Jem said, I did not come to you to talk about Kit. I came to talk about you and Julian.
He pushed his hair back from his face. He looked tired, the white streak in his hair more pronounced.
You asked me a long time ago about the Parabatai curse. What happens when two Parabatai fell in love? I told you what I knew, but I didn't dream you were asking for yourself.
Emma felt herself go still. She looked at Julian, who nodded.
He knows, Julian said in a flat sort of voice. Emma wondered what he was feeling. She couldn't quite read him, as she usually could, but they were likely both in shock. Everyone does now. Emma hugged her arms around herself.
But how?
I wish I had known, Jem said, though I can understand why you did not tell me. I have spoken with Magnus. I know all that you did to try to combat the curse. No one could have struggled more. But this is not a curse that can be undone, save by the destruction of every Parabatai bond in all the world. He looked at Emma with sharp eyes, and she felt the sudden weight of how very old Jem was, and how much he knew about people. Or at least, that's what was believed, and every attempt to investigate the curse turned up no records of what might happen if the curse were to be realized. We only knew the symptoms. Increased power with runes, ability to do things no other Nephilim could do. The fact that you broke the mortal sword, Emma, I am sure it was partly the strength of Cortana, and partly the power of the curse. But these were all things we only guessed at for many years. Then, the battle of 3 days ago happened. What of it do you remember?
Emma was dying in my arms, Julian said. His voice shook. It was strange, though. Normally, Emma would have felt a twinge inside her ribs, a flicker of his pain. Now, she didn't. There was a white light, and we were giants looking down. I don't feel what we felt, but I remember people looking like ants running around our feet, and feeling like we were on a mission. Like we were being directed. I don't know how to explain it. Like we were being told what to do, and we had no choice except to do it.
As if something were working through you, said Jem. A will greater than yours.
Emma put her hands to her chest.
I remember now. Zara stabbed me. I was bleeding.
She remembered again the feeling of burning and the world spinning away and down.
We were giants?
I need to tell you a piece of Nephilim history, said Jem,
though Emma wished he would stick more closely to the topic of giants. Had Emma and Julian turned into them?
Long, long ago, in the early history of Shadowhunters, there were huge demons that threatened the Earth. Much bigger than any demon we have now, save what greater demons can sometimes become. In that time, it was possible for Shadowhunters to become true Nephilim, giants on the earth. I have old woodcuts and drawings of them,
and the writings of those who saw them battling demons. He took a piece of paper from his pocket and read aloud. The land that we have gone through as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of great size. There we saw the Nephilim, and to ourselves we seemed like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them.
But this is history, said Julian. People don't turn into giants now.
A land that devours its inhabitants. Emma could not help but think of Thule and the stories of giants there.
Most did not survive their transformations, said Jem. It was the ultimate sacrifice, to blaze up with heavenly fire and die destroying demons. But it was noticed that many who survived were Parabatai. Shadow hunters were more likely to live through the transformation if they had a Parabatai who did not transform, anchoring them to Earth.
But we both transformed, said Emma.
You understand, Jem said, that for years we have tried to understand the Parabatai curse and what it might be, but we certainly never tied it into the time of Nephilim. The end of the time of Nephilim came when the giant demon ceased to come to Earth.
We don't know why they disappeared. They simply did. Perhaps they were all slain. Perhaps they lost interest in this world. Perhaps they feared the Nephilim. This was 800 years ago, and many records have been lost.
So when we turned into giants, said Julian, looking as if the words made him ill, you realized the Parabatai curse was tied to Nephilim somehow.
After the battle, we raced to turn up every record of the true Nephilim. In doing so, I discovered one tale of a terrible event. A shadow hunter became a true Nephilim to battle a demon. Their Parabatai was meant to stay behind as an anchor, but instead, they too transformed, uncontrollably. Both went wild.
They slaughtered the demon, and then they murdered their families and all those who tried to stop them, until they burned alive from the heavenly fire.
He paused. They were a married couple. In those days, there was no law against loving your Parabatai. Some months later, it happened again, this time with another pair of lovers.
And people didn't know about this? Said Emma.
Much was done to cover it up. The practice of Parabatai is one of the most powerful tools the shadow hunters possess. No one wanted to lose it. And since the great demons had vanished, it was not thought that there would be a need to employ true Nephilim again. Indeed, no one ever has, and the method by which true Nephilim were made has been lost. It could have ended there, and indeed there were no records in the Silent City of what happened. But Tessa was able to find an archive in the Spiral Labyrinth. It was a tale of two shadow hunters who became like warlocks, powerful magicians, whose runes were unlike others. They razed a peaceful town to the ground before they were burned to death. But I suspect they were not burned to death by the townspeople. I suspect they died from the heavenly fire. He paused. Not long after the date of this tale, the law was passed that no Parabatai could fall in love.
That's suspicious, muttered Emma.
So what you're saying, said Julian, is that the shadow hunters destroyed their own records of why they created the law about Parabatai love being forbidden? They were afraid that people would take advantage of the power, but they valued the benefits of Parabatai too much to give up the ritual?
That is what I suspect, said Jem. Though I do not think we will be able to prove it.
This can't keep happening, said Emma. We need to tell everyone the truth.
The truth won't stop it happening, said Julian. He looked at her steadily. I would have fallen in love with you, even if I had known exactly what the danger was. Emma's heart seemed to trip over itself. She tried to keep her voice steady.
But if the horrible punishments were taken away, she said, if people didn't think they'd lose their families, they'll come forward. Mercy is better than revenge, isn't it?
The Silent Brothers have conferred and agree with you, said Jem.
They will make a recommendation to the consul and the new inquisitor when he or she is appointed. But Gia?
Gia still is the consul, said Emma.
Yes, though she is very ill. She has been for some time. I hope that she will now have the time and space to rest and get well.
Oh. Emma was surprised. Gia had seemed invulnerable to her.
The cohort members who survived are being held in the guard prison. You did win the battle for us, after all, though I would not recommend trying that tactic again.
What's going to happen to us? Julian said. Will we be punished?
For what happened on the field, I do not think so, said Jem.
It was a war. You slew the riders of Manon, for which everyone is grateful, and you slew several cohort members, which you might have done anyway. I think you'll be curiosities now. True Nephilim have not been seen in centuries. Also, you may have to do community service.
Really? Said Emma.
Not really, said Jem, and winked at her.
I meant about the Parabatai thing, said Julian. We're still breaking the law by feeling like we do about each other. Even if they make the laws gentler, we'll still have to be separated, exiled even, so this never happens again.
Ah, said Jem,
and he leaned back against the wall, his arms folded.
When your clothes were cut from you so you could be healed here in the Basileus, it was noticed that your Parabatai runes had disappeared.
Emma and Julian both stared at him.
Now, a Parabatai rune can be cut from your skin, and you will not lose your bond, said Jem. The rune is the symbol, not the bond itself. But it was curious, because there were no marks or scars where your Parabatai runes had been. It was as if they had never been drawn.
The Silent Brothers looked into your minds, and saw the bond had been severed. He paused. In most cases, I would feel I was giving you bad news, but in this case, perhaps not. You are no longer Parabatai.
Neither of them moved or even breathed.
Inside Emma's chest, her heart seemed to be ringing like a bell in a vast space. The deep echo of a cavern whose roof was so high, all sound vanished into silence and dreams. Julian's face was as white as the demon towers.
Not Parabatai, he said at last, his voice like a stranger's.
I'll give you two a moment to digest the news, Jem said, a smile curling at the edge of his mouth. I will go to speak with your family. They have been worried about you. He left the room, and even though he wore jeans and a sweater, the shadow of robes seemed to move about him as he went. The door closed behind Jem, and still Emma couldn't move. The terror of letting herself believe that the horror was over, that it would be all right, kept her frozen in place. For so long she had lived with the weight on her shoulders. For so long it had been the first thing she'd thought of when she woke up, and the last of her thoughts before she slept. The food of nightmares, and the close of every secret fear. I will lose Julian. I will lose my family. I will lose myself. Even in the brightest moments, she had thought she would lose one of those things. She had never dreamed she would keep them all.
Emma, Julian said.
He had gotten to his feet, limping slightly, and Emma's heart broke. She knew this could be no easier for him than it was for her. She rose to her feet, her legs shaking. They faced each other across the space between their two cots. She didn't know who broke or moved first. It could have been her or him. They could have moved in unison as they had done for so long, still connected even though the Parabatai bond was gone. They collided in the middle of the room. She flung her arms around Julian, her bandaged fingers digging into the back of his shirt. He was here. Really here. Solid in her arms. He kissed her face feverishly and ran his hands through her hair. She knew tears were running down her face. She held on to him as tightly as she could, feeling him shaking in her arms. Emma, he was saying over and over, his voice breaking, shattering on the word. Emma,
Emma, my Emma. She couldn't speak. Instead, she traced her fingers clumsily across his back, writing out what she couldn't say aloud, as they had for so long. A-T-L-A-S-T, she wrote. A-T-L-A-S-T.
The door flew open, and for the first time ever, they didn't leap apart. They kept hold of each other's hands, even as their family and friends poured into the room, tearful and bright with happiness and relief.
They are quite afraid of you in Faerie now, Christina, said Kieran. They call you a slayer of kings and princes, a terrifying shadow hunter. The three of them, Mark, Christina, and Kieran, were sitting by a dry fountain in Angel Square, outside the Basilius. Christina sat between Mark's legs, his arms around her. Kieran leaned against his side.
I'm not terrifying, Christina protested.
You terrify me, Mark said, and Christina turned and made a face at him. Kieran smiled, but did not laugh. There seemed too much tension in him. Perhaps it was because it was difficult for him to be in Alicante. It had been heavily fairy-proof during the Dark War, iron and salt and rowan strategically deployed in nearly every street. The Basilius was covered in hammered iron nails, so Mark and Christina waited for news of Jules and Emma in the square with Kieran, letting the bright sun warm them as they rested. After the Dark War, Mark knew this square had been full of bodies. Corpses lay out in rows, their eyes bound with white silk, ready for burning and burial. Now it was peacefully quiet. There had been deaths in the battle 3 days before, and the next day a great funeral at the fields. Gia had spoken of the sorrow endured, of the necessity of building again and the importance of not acting in revenge against the cohort, 50 of whom were now in the guard jail.
My mother is the one who is terrifying, said Christina, shaking her head.
She was warm in Mark's arms, and Kieran was a comforting weight against his side. If it had not been for worry over Emma and Jules, he would have been perfectly happy.
I told her about us last night.
You did? Mark was agog. Christina's mother was terrifying. He'd heard that after the gates of the city had been opened by the Silent Brothers, she'd climbed up on one of the walls and thrown dozens of spears at the Unseelie fairies with a deadly precision that had sent redcaps scurrying away from the city. There was also a rumor that she'd punched Laszlo Balog in the face, but he decided not to confirm it.
What did she say? Kieran's black and silver eyes were worried.
She said that it was perhaps not the choice she would have made for me, said Christina. But that what mattered was that I was happy.
She also said she wasn't surprised it took two men to fill Diego's shoes. She grinned.
Because Diego saved my life, I will absorb that slight without retort, said Kieran.
And I'll tie his shoelaces together the next time I see him, said Mark.
Can you believe they found Manuel hiding under Horace's dead body?
I'm only surprised he did not cut Horace's body open and hide inside it, said Kieran, dourly. Mark punched him lightly in the shoulder.
Why did you strike me? Kieran protested.
It has been done in Faerie before. Once a cowardly warrior hid inside a kelpie for a week. Something white fluttered down from the sky, a moth, who deposited an acorn in Kieran's lap and winged away.
A message, Mark said.
Kieran unscrewed the acorn's top. He looked darkly serious, probably because he was now clad in the raiment of an Unseelie king. It still gave Mark a jolt to see him, all in black, black boots, black breeches, and a black waistcoat, sewed with embroidered waves of gold and green to symbolize Kieran's Nixie heritage.
From Winter, Kieran said. All the shadow hunters and downworlders are now returned from the Unseelie lands to their homes.
Kieran had opened the hospitality of the Unseelie court to those who fled the battle on the fields. Alec had said he thought the gesture would go a long way toward rolling back the laws of the Cold Peace. A meeting to discuss how the Clave would go forward was scheduled for the next day, and Mark was anxious for it. Kieran had not stayed long in the Unseelie court.
He had returned to Mark and Christina the day after the battle, and they had been glad to have him back.
"Look," Christina cried. She sat up, pointing. One of the windows of the Basilius had opened, and Drew had poked her head out. She was waving down at them, gesturing for them to come inside. "Emma and Julian are awake," she called. "Come up!"
Christina scrambled to her feet and the others followed.
Julian and Emma.
And Drew had been smiling. Now, Mark thought, now he was perfectly happy. He started toward the Basilius, Christina beside him. They were nearly there when they realized Kieran hadn't followed. Mark turned.
"Kieran?"
he frowned. "Is the iron too difficult?"
"It's not that," Kieran said. "I shall return to Ferry."
"Now?"
Christina said. "Now and forever," said Kieran. "I shall not come back from there."
"What?" Mark strode back toward Kieran. The white letter from Winter fluttered in Kieran's hand like the wing of a bird.
"Speak sense, Kieran." "I am speaking sense," Kieran said softly.
"Now that we know Emma and Julian will live, I must go back to Ferry. It is the bargain I made with Winter."
He glanced down at the letter. "My general summons me. Without a king, the land is at risk of falling into chaos."
"They have a king."
Christina had run to Kieran's side. She wore a light blue shawl. She drew it around herself tightly in agitation, shaking her head.
"You are their king, whether you are there or here."
"No," Kieran closed his eyes. "The king is linked to the land. Every moment the king is in the mortal world, the land weakens. I cannot stay here. I did not want to be king. I did not ask to be king, but I am king. And I cannot be a bad one. It would not be right."
"Well, we could come with you then," said Mark. "We could not stay in Ferry all the time, but we could visit."
"I thought that as well. But even after a short time as king in the court, I know otherwise now," Kieran said. His hair had gone entirely black under the slim gold circlet that now encircled his brow. "The king is not permitted to have a mortal consort."
"We know that,"
said Christina, remembering her words in Brosland. Even then, she had believed Kieran might not become king, that a way would be found.
"But your father had mortal consorts, didn't he? Isn't there some way around the rules?"
"No, he had mortal lovers." The word sounded ugly. "A consort is an official position. Mortal companions are playthings to be toyed with and tossed aside. He cared not about how they were treated, but I do care. If I brought you to court as such, you would be treated with contempt and cruelty, and I could not stand to see it."
"You are the king," Christina said. "They're your people. Can't you order them not to be cruel?"
"They've had years of a cruel reign," said Kieran. "I cannot teach them overnight. I did not know it myself. I had to learn kindness from both of you." His eyes glittered. "My heart is breaking, and I cannot see a way out. You are all I want, but I must do what is best for my people. I cannot weaken my land by coming here, and I cannot hurt you by bringing you there. We would never have peace in either place."
"Please, Kieran," said Mark. He caught at Kieran's wrist.
"I am holding the arm of the Unseelie King," he thought. It was perhaps the first time he thought of Kieran as the king, and not simply his Kieran.
"We can find a solution."
Kieran pulled Mark to him and kissed him, hard and suddenly, his fingers digging into Mark's wrist. When he let him go, he was pale, his cheeks burning with color.
"I have not slept for 3 days. This is why I wanted Adean to be king. Others want the throne. I do not. I only want you."
"And you will be a great king because of it," said Christina, her brown eyes glimmering with unshed tears. "What if it was only you and Mark? Mark is half fairy. Surely that must mean something."
"He is a shadow hunter to them," said Kieran, releasing Mark's hand.
He strode over to Christina. His eyes were smudged with tiredness.
"And I love you both,
My brave Christina. Nothing can change that. Nothing ever will. The tears she had been holding back spilled down her cheeks as Kieran cupped her face gently.
You are truly leaving? There must be another way.
There is no other way. Kieran kissed her swiftly and hard, as he had kissed Mark. Christina closed her eyes. Know that I will always love you, no matter how far away I am. He let her go. Mark wanted to protest, but more than Christina, he understood the cruel realities of Faerie, the thorns among the roses, what it would mean to be a toy and plaything of the king of a fairy court. He could stand it for himself, but not for Christina. Kieran leapt onto Windspear's back. Be happy with each other, he said, his eyes averted as if he could not bear to look at them. It is my wish, as king.
Kieran, Mark said.
But Kieran was already riding away with thunderous speed. The flagstones trembled with Windspear's retreating hoofbeats. Within seconds, Kieran was out of sight. Kit hated it in the Silent City. Even though his room was fairly comfortable, at least compared to the rest of the Silent City, which was all sharp-edged objects made out of human skeletons. Once you'd picked up three or four skulls and muttered, "Alas, poor Yorick," to them, the novelty wore off quickly. He suspected his rooms were a Silent Brothers' chambers. There were a lot of books on a wooden shelf, all of them about history and glorious battles. There was a comfortable bed and a bathroom down the hall. Not that he wanted to think about the bathroom conditions in the Silent City. He hoped to forget them as soon as possible. He had been left with little to do but heal and think about what had happened on the battlefield. He remembered, over and over, the surge of power that had gone through him when he'd struck the riders and made their horses disappear. Was it dark magic? Was that why he was locked up? And how was it possible he had fairy blood? He could touch iron and rowan wood. He'd lived his whole life surrounded by technology. He didn't look anything like a fairy, and no one in the Shadow Market had ever whispered at the possibility. It was more than enough to occupy his mind and keep him from thinking about Ty. At least it should have been. He was lying on the bed, staring at the stone ceiling, when he heard footsteps approaching in the hallway outside his room. His first thought was food. A Silent Brother brought him a tray of plain, nourishingly boring food 3 times a day. But the footsteps clicked on the stone. Heels. He frowned. The console? Diana, even? He'd play it cool and explain he hadn't done anything wrong. He sat up, running his fingers through his hair, and wondering how the Silent Brothers ever got anything done without owning mirrors. How did they know their robes weren't on backward? The door opened, and Tessa Gray came in. She wore a green dress and a hairband like Alice in Wonderland. She smiled at him affectionately.
Please break me out of here, said Kit. I don't want to be trapped in here forever. I didn't do anything wrong, especially not any necromancy.
Tessa's smile faded. She came over to sit down at the foot of the bed, her gray eyes worried.
So much for playing it cool, Kit thought. Christopher, she said, I'm sorry for having left you here for so long.
It's all right, he said, though he wasn't sure it was.
But don't call me Christopher. No one does.
Kit, she said.
I'm so sorry that we left you here. We were looking after Julian and Emma, so we couldn't leave the city. It was touch and go for a while, but they just woke up. She smiled. I thought you'd want to know.
Kit was glad to hear it, and yet...
What about the others? Are they okay? What about Ty?
Ty and the others are fine, and Emma is all right in part thanks to you. You saved her life. Kit slumped back against the metal headboard of the bed, relief coursing through him.
So I'm not in trouble for what I did on the battlefield?
No, Tessa said slowly. But you need to know what it means.
There's a story, one shrouded in mystery and misdirection. one that very few people alive know. Something about fairy blood, Kit said.
The rider, he said, Kit is the child, the descendant of the first heir. But I don't see how that would be possible.
Tessa smoothed her skirt over her legs.
Long ago, the King of Unseelie and the Seelie Queen formed an alliance to unite the fairy courts. They brought magicians from all over fairy to cast spells, ensuring that the child they had would be the perfect heir. Not all the magic was good magic. Some of it was dark. The king dreamed of a son who would unite the realms, inspire perfect loyalty and perfect love, who would be braver than any fairy knight that had ever gone before.
Sure sounds like me, muttered Kit. Tessa flashed him a sympathetic smile.
But when the child was born, she was a girl. Oraline.
Plot twist, said Kit.
The king had expected a male heir and was upset. In his eyes, the child was flawed, and eventually he set a fairy knight the task of having her killed, though the king had the tale put around that she had been kidnapped, and that is the story most believe.
The king planned to kill his own daughter?
Indeed. And he has had every daughter of his killed since, in bitterness over Oraline. For she defied him. She was still the heir. She called upon the knight's loyalty to her, and he let her go. That is what the king tried to hide. He pretended Oraline's death was the fault of another, even when Oraline fled to the mortal world. There she met a magician who became her husband. A magician who was descended from the line of shadow hunters who had left the clave.
The Lost Herondales, Kit guessed.
Correct. They were your ancestors. Their line led to your mother. Through all the decades, the Unseelie King has hunted those he thought were descended from his daughter. And so the Herondales have hidden, concealed by false names and powerful magic.
Why would the king do that? Said Kit.
Oraline inherited a great deal of magic. The spells done on her before and after she was born were powerful. She is called the first heir because she was the first fairy born who was the heir to the Seelie and Unseelie court both. And so are all her descendants. Your blood gives you claim to the high kingship of fairy.
What? Said Kit. But I don't want it. I don't want to be High King of Fairy.
It doesn't matter what you want, not to them, Tessa said sadly. Even if you never went near the throne of Fairy, there are warring factions who would love to get hold of you and use you as a pawn. An army with you at the head of it could take down the king or queen or both.
Goosebumps flooded along Kit's arms. But doesn't everyone know who I am now? Because of what happened with the riders? Are they hunting me?
Tessa put her hand on his wrist. It was a gentle, motherly touch. Kit could not remember such a touch in all his life. Only the memory of light, blonde hair, and the sound of a lilting voice singing to him. The story that I love you, it has no end. Part of the reason we kept you here these last few days was to reach out into Downworld to see if anyone has been talking about you, said Tessa.
We have many connections, many ways of following gossip in the markets. But with the chaos of the battle, all the talk is of the death of the riders, what happened with Emma and Julian, and Kieran's ascension. There have been words of a warlock who made the great horses of the riders vanish, but we have spread the word that it was Ragnar Fell. She rolled her eyes. I thought his name was Ragnar Shade.
It is Ragnar Fell, she said, and smiled in a way that made her look 19. He is a scamp, and has been in hiding for some years. He resurfaced in grand style during the battle, and now everyone knows Ragnar